or desire. So in the topics we talked about, I'm inserting this QCD section very briefly. It's just going to be whirlwind QCD, because I think it was pointed out that if you don't learn QCD in a standard model course, you know, where will you learn it? So this won't teach you QCD, but it'll say some of the folklore about QCD, so that you'll have a guide on which to base your further learning. So we're interested in the strong interactions in particular, because the big dirty secret, you know, we've talked about how things decay. We talked about how things interact. And it's all been assuming that the things doing decaying and interacting are the things that are in the Lagrangian of the standard model, and those are the quarks, and the leptons, and the gauge bosons. And you know, if you go to an experimentalist and ask them, you know, so what are the particles you deal with? They don't deal with quarks, right? And the gluons, you don't deal with. So there's a basic missing step is what's the connection between the degrees of freedom in the Lagrangian and the degrees of freedom that you actually see in real life. So the basic fact is the hadrons. So these are the hadrons are the strongly interacting particles, remember, you know, seen in nature, you know, are not quarks and gluons. And at some level, this is there's a mundane part of this, and there's an interesting part of this. The mundane part of this is that, so that's like if somebody was interested in atomic physics and you gave them quantum electrodynamics, and they said, well, the things we deal with are not electrons and protons, it's you know, atoms. The fact that bound states can exist and the degrees of freedom that are in your theory are not the ones that are the ones that you're seeing doesn't mean that there's a failure of description. So the part of the picture here is that you know, since the SU3 color couplings or coupling G3 is the largest. You know, it's comparatively large compared to the others. It can bound quarks, antiquarks, and gluons into bound states. It can bind, I guess, is the verb for bound states. So the first question you have is how big are these couplings? So you know from this morning's discussion that depends on where you ask the question. So we know that the couplings run. And so as a function of mu, if we graph, you know, alpha rather than 1 over alpha, which is what I graphed before, alpha being the coupling constant squared divided by 4 pi, then the SU3 is falling. And the SU2 is falling less quickly. And the U1 is growing. And they don't really intersect at the same place if you just use the standard model. Although it comes pretty close. So how big the couplings are depends on where you start. And I've drawn them in this particular way where these guys are the biggest one is this, because you can measure them, say, at the you know, as measured at you know, alpha 3 at the Z mass. That's a specific scale. That's around 0.1 or something. Let me just 0.12. And you can measure that by, for example, calculating decay rates of tau leptons or a cross section for E plus E minus goes to Z into hadrons and looking at the radiative corrections. Graphs that involve gluons, and those gluon graphs will involve alpha 3 because the coupling constant is now in the amplitude, and getting the description right will tell you how big alpha would be. So you, one of the things that emerges from these fits of the electroweak measurements is this value. Whereas, you know, the electromagnetic coupling at the same scale is something like 1 over 128. So this guy is bigger than the other ones. This is a particular combination of the other ones, but it's an experimental fact. And then it just gets bigger. So if this is a Z mass here, you know, you're just going up below that. So as you go to lower and lower scales, like the mass of the bottom quark or lower, you're getting a larger and larger contribution here, which is a calculable one. There's a scale. So that tells you that this interaction will be the first one to become strong. If you're looking for bound states, that's the one that you would expect at low energies to happen first. That if you had to have an interaction, one of these interactions bind things, it's most likely the strongest one that's going to bind, give you your bound states. And so you wouldn't be surprised from this that the strongly interacting things are the ones that are complicated in the spectrum. That's the first observation. Now, the second observation is we should be able to say what gets bound. You know, in electromagnetism, you can tell what kinds of things bind. And it's typically positive charges are attracted to negative charges, and they give you lower their energy by doing so. And they keep on doing that until they end up having neutralized the whole charge, and then what's left tends to be stable. So that you get atoms in the end of the day rather than, you know, than ions as the lowest energy configurations. There should be a similar statement for SU3 color because we understand SU3 color. And it should be true that if you ask the question, so it's going to be hard. It's typically hard to find bound states but that, in a complicated theory where interactions are not small. But what you can do is you can ask, you know, if someone asked you what configurations of electrons and positrons and protons are going to want to bind together, you don't actually have to find the wave function for what bound to decide what's the attractive channel, right? If you scattered an electron with an electron, you would know that it was repelling. They're repelling each other, and so they're raising their energy by getting close to each other. Whereas if you scattered an electron with a positron, you'd see that they're lowering their energy as they approach one another. And that in itself tells you that the electron-positron channel is the attractive one. And so you may not know what the bound state is that you get or what happens, but you can see that if you're going to get something interesting happening, a bound state happening, it's more likely to happen in the E plus E minus channel than in the E plus E plus channel or the E minus channel. So within perturbation, the point of that is that in perturbation theory, you can look at the scattering and you can see which channels are the ones that are lowering the energy, which ones are raising the energy, and that should be pointing to the kinds of bound states you'll get. The ones that lower their energy by getting together will be the ones that will probably bind, and how they bind and what's the stable configuration that's the lowest energy one, you can't identify in perturbation theory, but you can get a sense as to who, just the quantum numbers of what should be there using perturbation theory. So the second point is that you can evaluate which channels are, or which combinations are attractive with respect to the strong interactions. And see if that's describing the bound states that you know and love. So one way to think about this is that you know, a poor man's way of doing this would be in quantum mechanics, if you're calculating the energy levels in perturbation theory of some system, you know that there's this formula for the energy of the nth level is given in perturbation theory by the in non-degenerate perturbation theory by the matrix element of the interaction Hamiltonian. And there's a second order piece, which is sum over all the other things, but not this state of the matrix element divided by En minus Ek. And it's a plus sign. You know the sign because the variational principle says, you know, it's higher order. The variational principle says the ground state energy has to go down. And so if this is the lowest energy in the problem, this is always going to be negative, and that means that has to be plus sign to lower the energy all the time. So we can do this kind of an estimate for, say, a pair of quarks. So if you have a quark with color R, a quark with color S, I'm going to ignore all the other labels. Say that they have zero momentum, so they're at rest, and their spins are whatever they are. I'm not going to follow the spin here because the first approximation, it's not going to make a big difference, the spin. I just want to know what combination of colors is the thing that's likely to be attractive. Then I'm asking the analog of the question of what I would have done if I had, say, an electron, or an electron, and a positron. And I could make this argument. I could take the interaction terms in the standard model. So the interaction term that's relevant for the strong interactions here would be, you know, the IG3 quark bar MMU color matrix quark times the gluons. And here you would have had electromagnetic kind of an interaction. Fermion bar gamma mu, fermion a mu times maybe the electric charge matrix. And you could just apply this kind of a calculation of the energy level shift to this kind of a state and see if, you know, do you get a positive answer or a negative answer. Because this thing has got a photon there, this term is not going to typically contribute because none of the states involved have photons. And you've got a zero matrix element of the no photon state and the no photon state around a creation or destruction operator gives you zero. So everything starts here. And long story short, if you kind of do the sum over states, you're going to get the states that are, you're going to get a photon. This state K will be a photon state. And it may or may not have these fermions, depending on who's being created, who's being destroyed. But you can sum over them all, and you're going to get some answer. And so if I call this, this is the change in the energy of this two particle state for the E case. You know what the answer here is. Is you get something. The complicated part is doing the sum over all the kinematics. That gives you some number. Let's call it curly E. But what we know is at the end of the day, like charges repel, opposite charges attract. And so we get a number, which is, if I say that this is fermion 1, this is fermion 2, then what I'm going to get is something proportional to the charge of fermion 1, charge of fermion 2. If these charges are the same, this combination have the same sign, this combination is positive. And so this energy is supposed to go up because I know that like charges repel. If these charges have opposite sign, this is negative, and this energy goes down. So that tells me that whatever this thing is, I don't really care what it is. It's something which is positive. This number E is something positive. And that statement is the statement that like charges are going to repel, and unlike charges will attract. And so I would expect in this kind of a picture that unlike charges will be the things that will bind together. So the same kind of argument for quarks you can do, and all you have to do is follow the only difference is following the color label rather than following the electromagnetic charge matrix. And the stuff that goes into E is very similar. The things you're summing over in the virtual states are basically the same kind of kinematic combination. So I won't calculate it again. Because you know that it only has to be that if I take this thing and replace it by the charge, I have to get this with a sign which is positive if I take the charges out up front. So the same kind of an argument says that for two quarks, the issue here will be instead of what the relative charges is, the issue will be what's the total color combination that I can get when I combine two quarks. So each quark, so let's do a quark and an antiquark. Actually, that's probably the better thing to do. What we know is that the quark transforms as a 3 under SC3 color. And the antiquark transforms as a 3 bar. So if it had a label, let's say R here, and this has a label S going from 1 to 3, they transform differently because this is a complex conjugate representation of this one. If I take two of them, the combination Q R Q bar S is something which has a think of that as being a matrix in color space. It has an index, two indices that are different from one another. The one's a triplet index, one's an anti-triplet index. I'd like to ask the analog of the question, if we've been talking about spins, and so the symmetry we're interested in was SU2, then you know that if I had a spin a half particle and a spin a half particle, and I combine them, I can think of that as being You think of that as being a spin zero particle plus a spin one particle, right? So this thing, if I ask how does this thing transform under rotations, it turns out that it's a reducible representation. There's an invariant combination where the spins, you know, pair off oppositely, which is invariant under rotations. And there's another combination where the spins pair off and add up, which is three of them fall together into a spin one state. I want to ask the same question for color when I have a triplet and an anti-triplet. And what I'm basically asking for are what are the kinds, if I take 3x3 matrices and ask how do they transform under the symmetry, and the symmetry, remember, was Q goes to a unitary matrix, so QR goes to a unitary matrix, and R S times Q sub S. And so Q bar S R goes to the complex conjugate matrix. We want to know how many ways can we organize these things. If I do this transformation on this thing, then I'm going to get a U. This matrix under this transformation, you can think of this as being Q bar transpose as a matrix. This is going to transform into M is going to go to U times M U dagger. It's got a complex conjugate here, and then it's a dagger because I've kind of transposed it by making this a column index rather than a row index. And so if I ask for 3x3 matrices, what are the options as to how things can transform? You know, there's 9 matrices there. We know that if we put the unit matrix in here, it transforms into itself because U times unit matrix times U dagger gives me back the unit matrix because these are unitary matrices. Right? So I know that that 1 goes to itself under that transformation. And the other matrices, they will go into linear combinations of each other. And the question is, if I keep repeating this with different elements of the group, do I end up getting all of the remaining 8 matrices, or do I get a subset? And the answer turns out to be that all of the remaining 8 matrices get related to one another by symmetry transformations. And I can think of those remaining 8 matrices as being the Gell-Mann matrices, the ones that we've been using to represent color here. Those 8 things satisfy that U dagger lambda U is some linear combination of the lambdas. So the lambda alpha satisfies that U dagger is some matrix, you know, we call it N alpha beta times lambda beta. That's the statement that they carry. That's what you mean when you say that they carry a representation of SE3 color. So these 8 guys transform into one another, and this one is all by itself. And so another way of writing this is that it's useful to think of this as being, I can write any matrix M R S as being a number times the unit matrix delta R S plus another set of numbers times these Gell-Mann matrices. So I could have a B alpha lambda alpha R S. That decomposition of this combination has the property that this transforms into itself under SE3 color, and these ones also transform into each other. And so the way you would write that along the lines of the spins would be that we have a triplet. We take the product with an anti-triplet, and that decomposes as a singlet plus an octet representation. That's the group theoretical statement that I'm making here. So the options for deciding what energy here in color language would be, we would want to know which of these is the attractive channel. If I take this combination and I put it in a singlet combination, does the energy go down or up when I look at the perturbation to the energy due to the strong interactions? And I can ask the same question about the octet thing. And the basic story, you know, long story short, is the mechanics of the calculation is identical to what you're doing in electromagnetism because the kinematics is essentially the same. All that's really changing between this and this is the group theory of how these matrices combine with one another in color space. That's the main difference between this and this. If I follow what the color indices do here, the thing that pre-multiplies that will be the same thing I was doing over here. So I may not know what the value is, but I'll know the sign of the value, because I know what the right answer is for electromagnetism. I know that opposite things attract. And so the bottom line is that let me erase this. If I ask for this energy of the write this in a way which is not going to be wrong. The energy for the singlet combination. Let me just write it as one. The one combination. That's some number. It's going to have two powers of the strong interacting coupling. I could have explicitly written the factor of e squared here if I wanted to follow the coupling constant. So it's got two of those. I don't know if I bother keeping the pi's around. I keep some numerical factors here, which are probably not so important. Let me write it the way I did in the book, just so you can kind of see it. Let me just write the answer. So it's a number times the there's a factor of I'm using a convention in what this number is, so I'll write what I wrote just so you don't have trouble finding what I wrote. So in some units, this is negative. And if I compare this to what happened to electromagnetic charge, I know that E should be positive, because the kinematics of this calculation is the same as that one. I don't know what it is, but it's positive. And in that same normalization, the same thing for the octet here would have been plus 1/6. Same E, because the only difference between these two things is how the color indices combine along the lines of this. And so that shows you that the singlet channel is attractive at weak coupling, whereas the octet is repulsive. So that just says that your intuition should be that if I combine these things, the singlet combination, this one combination is going to like to get closer together, and this one is not going to particularly want to get closer together. So that would lead you to believe that you should be finding that kind of actually has a lot of sense. You know, what happened for electromagnetic interactions was the attractive channel wanted to remove the charge, right? The positrons, the protons and electrons attracted because their charges were opposite, and they kept on attracting until they got to something which was electrically neutral. And that was the thing that stopped attracting things. And that's what's happening here. The thing that likes to form is the thing that has no color, and it no longer will attract things. If you were in a world where things like to have more color going from a triplet to a octet by binding together, then what would stop that? They would get even more color, and you'd produce things with more and more and more and more color. Something very dramatic could happen there. This is much more like electromagnetism, where the bound states are trying to remove the color as best they can, and that's what the energy prefers. Fine, so that's good. And the good news is if you look at, so what kind of things would you expect? So then you'd expect, and what are the list of quarks that we have? We've got up quarks, down quarks, strange quarks, charmed quarks, bottom quarks, and top quarks. We should be expecting to find these things. They pair off. The colors all pair off, and there's no net color in the bound states. But we should expect to find basically any pair of these things with any other pair of the U bar, the D bar, S bar, C bar. Should bind together. And another thing you should do, let me just kind of quote this rather than going in detail, but the book kind of gives you more information. If you ask for the quantum numbers of these bound states, you know, if the interactions are weak, if someone asks you to estimate the binding energy of these things, you know that how big was the binding energy in for electromagnetism? So for an E plus E minus pair, which is very similar to these things, and these things are basically interacting weakly because electromagnetism is a weak force. So the changes in their energy is due to the interaction is small compared to the rest mass. And so you're expecting that the binding energy that we're looking at over there is small compared to the rest mass of the particle that started off with. So they're probably going to be non-relativistic bound states. That the motion associated with the orbiting or the interaction is going to be small because the energy in that is not much compared to the energy that was intrinsically to the rest mass of the particles. And so one way of, you know, you can verify that if you take your energy, your Hamiltonian, to be p squared over 2m, you know, minus charge squared over r, like you do in, or let me just say e squared over r, like you do in electromagnetism, you know, if you use the physical argument that, you know, you'd like to minimize this energy, this likes the relative positions, so this r is the distance between the electron and the positron, let's say. If the potential energy likes them to get closer together, but the uncertainty principle hates them to be too close to each other because you're localizing them too much. You stick something in a well, and you pay an uncertainty principle price. So if you've got a potential well like that, if you localize me into some distance d, my momentum on average is going to be, you know, bigger than or of the order of h bar over d, so 1 over d in the units I'm using. So if this is, if d is of order of the separation r, you're expecting the uncertainty principle to forbid you from getting kinetic momentum smaller than 1 over r. So that says that as a function of r, this is something like, you know, 1 over 2m r squared, if you think of this as being momentum of order 1 over r, minus e squared over r. And this kind of shows you the trade-off. This grows for small r faster than this shrinks for small r. So there's going to be some minimum r where the trade-off between these two terms will be optimized, which you can find by just differentiating this thing. So if you take ddr equals 0, that points you towards r is of the order of 1 over e squared m, which is the Bohr radius, right? That's a 1 over the order alpha m is really the 1 over alpha m. So that says that the momentum is of the order of alpha m, because that's 1 over r. And the energy is of the order of p squared. These two terms are roughly the same size when this is true. So the energy is of the order of p squared over 2m, or e squared over r, whichever you like. And that both of those things lead you to alpha squared m, because you've got two of those things. And so that says that the speed, you know, v over c, is of the order of p over m. And that's of the order of alpha. So that it's non-relativistic because alpha is weak. And so that kind of a picture should apply equally well here, provided that the interaction is sufficiently weak. And we know that the interaction is sufficiently weak, provided that the distance between two things is sufficiently small, because that corresponds to large scales. And we know that the strong interactions get weaker and weaker the larger the energy scale we look at. So, in particular, you can ask self-consistently. If I take a separation like this, and I ask, you know, you give me a quark, and then I know what the mass is here, I could ask, I could take this position that I get. So supposing we take the strongly interacting coupling and rather than the electromagnetic coupling, and we evaluate it at this radius corresponding to the, you know, self-consistently at this bound, at this, at the radius defined by this expression, and ask, into first approximation, we can just take alpha here to be the value at the z mass, which is 0.1. And then we could figure out how big this Bohr radius is for a given mass. And then we could say, well, now that Bohr radius is not corresponding to an energy scale of the z mass. It's a different scale. So then we could correct alpha to that scale and then kind of self-consistently ask, you know, where does it converge to? And what happens is that if the mass of this thing is sufficiently heavy, then the alpha that you find for the separations involved in the bound state, you know, are small. And so then this picture, this electromagnetic picture should work very well. But if the masses are sufficiently light, then then the separations involved will be, you know, the smaller you make m, the bigger r will be, the bigger the strong coupling will be, and eventually it'll be true that alpha is no longer small enough to say that it's non-relativistic, and then this whole picture is going to start to fail. So to get a sense as to the energy scales involved, it's useful to have in mind this Coulombic kind of argument. And it's useful to have in mind what the mass is where this whole thing is going to start to break down. And there's only one scale in the problem. If you go to that's not quite true. There's two scales of the problem, but let me give you the folklore, which is, you know, has behind it real calculations, but I'm kind of skip over. So if so for the strong interactions, the electromagnetic analogy should work for R large enough. So the question is how large? That alpha of R is much less than 1. So we want to know, when does alpha become 1? What we know is that 1 over alpha for some scale is equal to 1 over alpha for another scale plus b alpha squared times the logarithm of 2 squares. And we know for QCD that this b is the one that makes alpha get smaller as mu gets larger, so I have to always figure that out. So B is positive because mu gets larger, this gets larger, and that means this has to be getting smaller. So this number for QCD is positive. So you could ask, well, supposing that I know that at the Z scale, Z mass, I know that alpha 3 and mz is 0.12. So that's a small number. I needed the alpha to be small to believe this formula. If I go to higher values of mu, it just gets better and better because alpha gets even smaller still. Lower values, eventually this fails. And so where does it fail? It fails once alpha starts to become order 1. And so you could ask, for what values of mu does alpha become order 1? So it turns out that for mu of the order of something like 100 MeV, it depends. There's an issue here. It's exactly the criteria I'm going to use. I could ask, when does alpha 3 using this formula go to infinity, say? That wouldn't really mean that alpha 3 really does go to infinity because this formula breaks down first. But that's a simple thing to talk about because if it goes to infinity, this is 0. I could just solve for mu in that case, and it's a very simple formula. I could say instead that, well, maybe the problem with perturbation theory starts when alpha, normally the problem with perturbation theory starts when alpha is over order 4 pi because the thing that's controlling loops is alpha over 4 pi. And I could ask, what's the mu for which that happens? And the answer I get will depend on exactly what question I ask. But they're all in the ballpark of 100 MeV to a GeV and that, in that range. Alpha 3. So I'm being vague here because it depends exactly how you phrase the question. Alpha 3 becomes greater than or order 1. So the criterion that this things should look electromagnetic if all the scales that you're led to, the Bohr radius in particular, it corresponds to an energy or a momentum which is large compared to that scale. This is the characteristic scale of the strong interaction. So the lambda QCD in the ballpark of 200 MeV, and again, depends how you define it, is often called the QCD scale. And it's defined as the place where the strong interactions become non-perturbative. And however you quantify that, that will pin down exactly what you mean by that scale. So the criterion for the electromagnetic picture is that, so we expect QED-like bound states with binding energies, delta E, much less than the mass of the quarks involved, or QQ bar pairs, same quark, if the mass of the quark is much bigger than this QCD scale. So if you go back and think of what the mass of the quarks are, this one is at 180 odd GeV, so that's certainly a great shape. This one is at 5-ish GeV. This is a GeV or so. This is a few hundred MeV. So this is right kind of in the ballpark of where lambda QCD is. And these are a few MeV, five or 10. So qualitatively, you're expecting that, you know, these guys should look QED-ish like. And the bigger the mass, the better. So these ones look even more QED-ish than these ones do. And these ones, if you could see them long, you know, this decays pretty fast, so it's kind of hard to see them. But the picture should be getting better and better for the heavier masses. So here, that's effectively the CV. And so the things like the CC bar, the BB bar states, and the TT bar states would be like that. And this means not just the ground state, but you know, in electromagnetism, you have the whole Balmer series, right? You have an energy which is, you know, some constant divided by n squared. So it's of the order some constant times alpha squared mass divided by n squared. And you should be expecting to see all these states, and they're labeled by quantum numbers L and S and N, just like they were for the hydrogen atom. And so you're expecting to find positronium-like states here. And so you shouldn't find one meson. You should find a whole configuration of them corresponding to different quantum numbers. And so you expect a whole spectroscopy of mesons here. And they'll have different spins depending on what their orbital angular momentum is and what their spin angular momentum is. One thing that's interesting about them compared to an atom is that they have very specific parity and charge conjugation quantum numbers, because parity is a good symmetry of the strong interactions. It's a bad symmetry of the weak interactions. But these bound states are all to do with the strong interactions. So we should be able to label these states by the symmetries C and CP. Those are all symmetries that are not exact for the standard model, but they're only broken by the weak interactions. So for what we're looking at, they're good symmetries. And so because a fermion and its antifermion have related, if you ask for the parity of an atom or something, the thing is that the intrinsic parity, there's a parity associated with the orbital angular momentum, say, because the wave function for angular momentum odd tends to be odd under taking r equals to minus r. The parity is reversing the direction of space. And so the orbital angular momentum quantum number will want the wave function to change sign. But the intrinsic parity of the particles involved themselves could be arbitrary. It might be that the proton could be parity odd. That means the parity acting on a proton and not moving at all gives you a minus sign. So the whole parity of the wave function of a proton and electron will depend on the intrinsic parity of electron and of the proton separately, in addition to their quantum number. So what you should expect here is that for the hydrogen atom, the parity of an s orbital and a p orbital have definite relationship to one another, but the absolute parity of each you don't know until you know the parity of a proton and electron. But for quark antiquark pairs, the parity of a quark tells you the parity of the antiquark. So the absolute parity quantum number of the whole thing is dictated just by its quantum numbers. And so they've related parity and C quantum numbers. So if this picture is right, you should be expecting bound states that are QED-like and for the heavy quarks, but not necessarily QED-like for the light quarks. And they should have very specific kinds of quantum numbers. And I don't know if I need to show you the table here, but it's the bottom line is that why don't I show it to you? So if you take the angular momentum, let's take the total angular momentum J L. I want to draw a table here. Let me remember what the axes are. So if this is the orbital angular momentum, this is the spin angular momentum. And this is the total angular momentum. This is the charge conjugation quantum number. And this is the parity quantum number, assuming the quarks are spin a half. And this is what the parity would have been if the quarks had been spinless, which they're not, but it's just to show you how it could be different. So if you had, you know, 0, 0, 1, 1, these are S wave and these are P wave. Here's the, they're both spin a half in this case. So in this case, this column only makes sense when it's spin a half because you've got two spin a half quarks, and so they can combine to be spin a half or spin 0. The spin quantum number is. So the total angular momentum here would be 0, here it's 1, here it's 1, and here you have a choice, right? It could be 0, 1, or 2. And the charge conjugation for these turns out to be plus, minus, minus, plus. And the parity for these turns out to be minus, minus, plus, plus. But if they'd been spinless, then then these options aren't really these options are really the same, so they're gonna, there's really only one number I gotta show you here. And that would be, in this case it's plus, in this case it's minus. So you, and it, now the, you know, I'm telling you this, I told you that story to tell you this story, that if you actually go out and look at the mesons that you see in life, you get exactly these ones and no more and no less. So you get things that have no color, you get things that are labeled by these kind of quantum numbers. If you're looking at things involving the quarks, the heavy quarks, you get these particles are called the JSI particles, and they have exactly these kind of labels, and they have the hydrogen-like, this kind of energy levels. And you can see the hyperfine splitting and all the things you see in atoms, and they have exactly these kind of quantum numbers, consistent with the quarks being spin a half. If you do it for these guys, this is called the epsilon particles, and it's the same kind of a story again, that they're very close to twice the mass of a bottom quark. And these ones haven't been seen because they decay too fast. But you really do see, spinless, often you quote this as JPC. So you see, spinless minus plus mesons corresponding to this combination, or you see spin one minus, what is it, minus minus mesons corresponding to this combination. These ones have orbital angular momentum, so these are like excited states of these ones. So these are kind of like this. You expect these to be the stable ones, and these will be the things that quickly decay into these ones because they can decay through a strong interaction, just like an excited atom can decay into a ground state atom through an electromagnetic interaction. So since these are like P wave, if you like, these are S wave. They differ only in how the spins are oriented. And you see literally these, you're expecting to see, for the heavy quarks, you see them. For light quarks, you see them, their mass is not well described by the hydrogen formula, but you see particles with the right quantum numbers, and the counting of them is right. You see, you're expecting this 3 times 3 is 9 kinds of mesons, which should have these kind of quantum numbers. There should be a bunch of spinless ones and a bunch of spin one ones, and their charge conjugations should alternate. They should all be pseudoparticles. Pseudoscalars or pseudovectors, and they are. And you see exactly those, and no more, and no less. You can sometimes see excited versions of them, but they really do what they're supposed to do. And so the ones involving these guys are the ones that were discovered historically originally. So the, the U, if you wrote a matrix out, U bar, U D bar, U S bar, D U bar, D D bar, D S bar. You can, this thing, it's useful in the same way that, and I almost certainly have erased it by now. When we had two colors, it was useful to group those things as a linear combination of the unit matrix and the Gell-Mann matrices, because those transformed in simple ways under rotating the three colors. For these, for the rotations amongst these three flavors, the same thing is true. It's useful to write this as being something times the unit matrix plus something else times Gell-Mann matrices, but now these are living in flavor space. Because those would be the things that transform in a simple way under rotating these things amongst one another, and I'll argue for you in a little bit that that's such a symmetry of strong interactions. So if you write that out, these things are typically what you would call the mesons. These particular linear combinations are the ones that you see in nature. And those are the ones that are famous. So it's, and rather than remembering it, let me just write it out for you just so you see it once. So this would be, if I look at the spinless, if I look at these guys, I'm going to take a new board here just to make this readable. So u bar what the hell am I doing here? UDS. So if I just write this thing out, and I'm going to write the C's and the B's explicitly as the physical things that people call mesons that they find. This is pi 0. So what I'm writing here, eta naught is C. The coefficient of lambda 8 is eta 8, and the coefficient of lambda 3 is what I'm going to call pi naught. And so I'm just giving names to these coefficients because those are the ones that you typically see in the experiments. And so you see that the pi naught came with a plus sign and a minus sign. That's, you remember, the third Gell-Mann matrix is really the third Pauli matrix in the upper left corner, 1, minus 1, and then zeros everywhere else. That's kind of why that's there. This is the unit matrix. This will always have the same coefficient all the way down. And this one, the lambda 8, had two equal coefficients and then an opposite one at the bottom. So it's kind of. So if you invert that matrix, you can read off what the, so the pions are mesons that are seen, kaons are mesons that are seen, the k plus and k minus are antiparticles. You kind of, at the quark level, there, that's this combination. The, you know, the electric charge of this is 2/3, the electric charge of this is plus 1/3, so that's a charge plus one state. And the same thing here, so you can read off the electric charges. But also you can read off the other things. These two pairs are electrically neutral because the down and the strange quark have the same charge. So the anti-strange has the opposite charge. But they're different from one another in the strong interactions because they're distinguished by strangeness. If you turn off the weak interactions, the strange quark and the strangeness and downness and upness are conserved quantum numbers because nothing ever does a transition between the two. It's only the weak interactions that do that. So these things are neutral, electrically neutral scalars that are not their equal to their antiparticles, but they're distinguished by a conserved quantum number, which in this case is strangeness, the S bar versus the S. And it's conventional, you should be aware of this, that the thing which has the anti-quark in it is the K meson, whereas the thing with the quark in it is the anti-K meson for historical reasons, that they found the mesons before they were thinking what the quarks meant. So that's just kind of an oddity of the nomenclature. But it shows you that things like the pi 0, it turns out that it's not such a good approximation to think of it as being UU bar or DD bar. It's really a linear combination of the two. It's proportional to 1 over root 2, you know, UU bar minus DD bar. So it's a superposition of those flavor states. That's the thing that transforms in a simple way under the symmetry that rotates the quarks, which is going to turn out to be a good approximation of symmetry of the strong interactions. So on the other hand, you know, K plus transformed like a US bar. So it was very simple to say what that was, because there's a unique state that had those quantum numbers. And there's a similar set of spin 1 mesons, these guys. And you can write them all down. You know, instead of the pis, they're called rows. So for spin 1, you know, the rho naught would be 1 half UU bar minus DT bar. But now what's happening is that the spins are aligning in the plus spin plus 1 arrangement. So you see what you expect to see. The energy levels in this case are not well described by hydrogen-like things, but the intuition they have for that is that in the strong interactions, if you bring these quarks close enough together, closer than the basic scale in the problem, this defines the distance, right? If you take RQCD and you say that that's just 1 over lambda QCD, if you separate things by less than that scale, they're interacting weakly. If you separate them by more than that scale, they're interacting very strongly. And one way to think qualitatively about the strong interactions is it's as if the strong interactions don't like charges to get separated by more than this distance. So it's like putting these quarks into a well of size RQCD. If you take the quarks and their Bohr radius was this big, they don't really know they're in a well. And so then they look very much like a hydrogen atom. But if you put them in and they're light enough that their Bohr radius was this big, then before they get to see the Bohr radius, something else is more important and really confines them into this well. And so in a well, you expect that the energy levels are going to be basically set, you know, in this kind of a picture, the momentum that you get by being confined in that radius is going to be of the order of 1 over the size of the thing you were stuck in, which is of the order of the QCD scale. And if that's bigger than the mass, you know, the energy associated with that momentum is the square root of p squared plus m squared. So if the mass was large compared to p, then really the Bohr radius would have been large, small compared to this confinement scale. So you're looking at a non-relativistic situation because the momentum is going to be small compared to m. But if the mass of the quark is small compared to the QCD scale, as is true for the up and the down and possibly the strange quark, then what you're expecting is that this, to a good approximation, is just p, because this is bigger than m, and so that's something like lambda QCD. So what you should expect is that for light quarks, you get bound states whose energy is going to cluster around this scale lambda QCD. It's not going to really care much what the mass of the quark is. But if you have heavy quarks, then they're close enough together because the potential well is deep enough, because their Bohr radius is short enough, that they're dominated by the interactions, the hydrogen-like or the electromagnetic-like interactions that are relatively weak, making their binding energies non-relativistic, and meaning that they're much more hydrogen-like in their energies. So that's the story for mesons. And the story for baryons is very similar. So the baryons are, you know, this whole story started with what's the attractive channel for quark-antiquark pair. But we could have asked the question for a pair of quarks. And the bottom line is for the baryons, there's a similar story. You can't make a singlet out of two quarks, but you can make a singlet out of three quarks. And the rule is basically that the strong interactions are trying to give you a color-neutral combination. So if you take two quarks, Q, R, and QS, I can always write that as a symmetric and an anti-symmetric combination. So ARS plus SRS. And I do that because, you know, under the symmetry we're interested in, where Q goes to U times Q, this goes to U transpose, or I guess it'd be U, so Q bar, QQ transpose, this matrix would go to U, QQ transpose, U transpose. And if this is symmetric, so is this. So symmetry and anti-symmetry are preserved by this transformation rule. So if I ask the same question as to who's transforming into whom under color, this combination is going to break up into the symmetric and anti-symmetric part. That for free has got to be things. This will transform into itself. That transforms into itself. And I can talk about them being symmetric and antisymmetric because these labels are identical. And I couldn't do that for the quark antiquark, where they were really different things. One was a complex quantity of the other. It might be, you know, it's logically possible you could have gotten a subset of these things to transform into one another, but it turns out that that's not true. That this really, these two things are the things that are irreducible. So if you take a triplet with a triplet, you get an antisymmetric 3x3 matrix has three things in it, right? So you get a three, something with three indices. Turns out to be an anti-triplet for a reason I'll tell you about in a second. And then what's left is, you know, we had nine things here, there's three here, there must be six things here. So there's a six-dimensional representation of SU3. The anti-triplet part of it comes about because the notation I'm using, where, you know, a quark has an index downstairs and an anti-quark has an index upstairs, is a very suggestive notation. And that's because in SU3, or SUN, but SU3 in particular, there's two things that define the group, right? SU3, you know, the U means it's unitary. U dagger U equals one. And that, in terms of the matrix, says that one is an invariant matrix. Or in terms of indices, you know, delta RS is invariant. And the S here says that the determinant of U is equal to one. That's what the special unitary transformations are. And another way of writing that is to say that epsilon RST times U R, I guess U R prime R U S prime S U T prime T is equal to epsilon R prime S prime T prime. The general statement would have been this is equal to this times the determinant of U. That's the index way of writing that. And so that says that if the determinant is one, that says that this three-dimensional antisymmetric thing, this is the thing which is one, epsilon 1, 2, 3 is plus 1. Everybody else is obtained by antisymmetry. So if you have two indices the same, it's 0. Otherwise, you can get it from this by antisymmetry. So there's two invariant tensors of the group is what that says. And you can use those. This notation where you raise and lower indices for the complex conjugate representation is very convenient, because it says that this statement says that I can make an invariant just by contracting the indices. That's what we found already. We had a singlet where we, which was the unit matrix in this combination. And I can also make a singlet with by taking QR, QS, or say Q bar R, Q bar S, Q bar T times epsilon RST. That's the invariant which has got no color in it. Because this is an invariant tensor, is what that says. And these things all transform by pulling U's out, and the U's combined with this to give it back another epsilon, according to that. So the bottom line is that supposing I remove this guy, that's something which I could call, you know, X sub T. That's something which transforms in exactly the same way as a quark did. And so when I say that this three is a three bar, that's like saying I have two three bars, I combine them with this particular combination and I get something transforming like a quark. That would be a three. This would be saying a three bar cross a three bar is a three. So this statement here would be that epsilon RST QR QS, if I call that YT, that transforms like an anti-quark, not like a quark, because its index is upstairs. So that's one way of thinking about this statement here. So you can kind of see that two quarks don't give you something colorless, but three can, because this combination will like to pair off with the third quark and give you a singlet. And so so the only way to get a singlet, a color singlet, is by taking a quark antiquark pair, or two quarks, or three quarks, or the complex conjugations, which are the same thing again. So for this one, but not for this one. So you'd have also Q bar S, Q bar S, Q bar T, T. Or I could take products of these things. I could take this with this. Would also be color, it would have no color, because each of them individually has no color. But there's no independent combination apart from these three. And these account for exactly the mesons that have been found. And these account for exactly the baryons that have been found. In exactly the same way, if we went through the whole story and counted what combinations we were allowed to get, and we asked how they transformed under shuffling these three, the U's and D's and S's together, you get exactly a one-for-one statement is exactly what all the baryons are that have been found. You know, the proton, the neutron, and its friends. And no more and no less. And so that there really is a convincing correspondence with the existing baryons. They have the pattern that for these light quarks, they typically have masses that are all in the ballpark of a GeV. The proton is, you know, almost a GeV, and then there's the other ones are kind of few GeV. They kind of work their way up. The excited states get more and more energetic. But they all have kind of a characteristic mass, which does not depend on the mass of the quark involved, because the quark mass involved is so small compared to the momentum involved that you're dominated by the binding energy of the proton and not by the mass of the quark that's inside of it, say. So it's a very successful picture as to what you should be expecting to see, with a couple exceptions that look like they might be exceptions. The lightest meson are the pions, and they come in at about 140 MeV. And so that, you could think, is actually small compared to the typical scale. You know, after that, the next lightest one is the kaon. So these Ks are something like 490 something, right? It's something like 500 MeV. Someone should correct me on that if I'm wrong. I'm just pulling up the memory. So if they're all kind of the same ballpark, from here on up, you start getting other ones. The rho is 600, 700 something or 600 something. They kind of work their way up from here. But the only one that's significantly lighter than those scales is this one. And that's kind of a, you might think that's a bit of a puzzle because it's we're expecting them all to be in the same ballpark. But there's actually a good reason why the pion would want to be lighter than all the other ones, it turns out. And that is that to understand that, we need to think more about what the symmetries are of the strong interactions. So the question is, what are the approximate symmetries strong interactions alone? So if we take throw away everything but the quarks and the gluons, and what we would have had is minus 1/4 g alpha mu nu minus, you know, sum over all the quarks of q bar d slash, let me say d slash plus m quark Q, where D is the thing that involves the gauge couplings of the gluons to the quarks. Now, if this term had not been there, so what we know is that the up quark is about 5 MeV. The down quark, it turns out to be about 10 MeV. The strange quark was something like 200 MeV. The charm quark mass was something like 1.5 GeV. The bottom quark is in the ballpark of 5 GeV. And the top quark is something like 180 GeV. So they divide up in that this one is close to lambda QCD. These two are light. And these ones are all heavy. Relative to the basic scale in the problem. So for these ones, it's actually useful to think about, particularly for these ones, which are the ones that are involved in the pion. It's particularly useful to think of the limit where the mass is just turned off, because it's actually should be a pretty good approximation to what's going on, because the binding energy is mostly to do with confining these things inside some sort of a region, and not much to do with the mass of the particles. So for up and down quarks, for sure, and possibly for S quarks, the limit where MQ is taken to zero should be a good approximation. So it's good to think about the symmetries in that limit. So in that limit, what would be the symmetry? So if you turn the masses off, so if m quark is equal to 0, so we have q is u, d, and s, let's say. And you might want to turn s off, depending on how well you want this to work. What you should be thinking of is that we're doing a series approximation here now. So we're interested in expanding the powers of m quark divided by lambda q to d. And so this turning it off the mass is a leading approximation, and then we'll perturbatively turn the mass back on again and work in that approximation. That's called chiral perturbation theory. And that should work really well for the up and down quarks, because that should be, that ratio is at least a tenth, but smaller than that probably. Whereas for the strong, strange quark, it's kind of a bit of an iffier call. Well, in that limit, the symmetries of the QCD Lagrangian over there is the quark, in addition to the gauge symmetry, I'm looking for global symmetries. It's delta Q is equal to I, say parameter 1, what do I call it? Theta alpha vector times lambda alpha over 2 q. So remember that any unitary 3x3 matrix can be written as e to the I theta alpha lambda alpha over 2. These are the generators of SU3. I did this for SU3 color before, and now I'm doing it for the rotation of these three flavors. So this describes an infinitesimal version of just taking q to uq, which is what I've been talking about till now. But there's another symmetry you could also have had, which I didn't talk about, which is I theta alpha axial times lambda alpha over 2 times gamma 5 times q. That's also symmetry in the limit that the mass is turned off. And so that says that you take the left and the right-handed quarks and you know, in terms of if I wrote this as a Dirac spinner, the left and right-handed pieces are doing the same thing here, whereas in this case, the left and right-handed things are doing the opposite things. So another way of saying this would be that the left-handed quarks go to a unitary matrix U left times the left-handed quarks, whereas the right-handed quarks go to an independent matrix U right times the right-handed quarks. That's another way of saying the same thing. So this is a symmetry SU3 left cross SU3 right. And if you only believed that we should be using two quarks, then you'd have SU2 left cross SU2 right. And this combination is kind of the where we take the diagonal combination where the left and the rights are doing exactly the same thing. That's also often called the vector combination. And this is the combination where we take this transformation and we do the inverse transformation here. And that's the axial transformation. And so up until now, when I talked about quarks and mesons and baryons, I was rotating everybody together, and I was really talking about this combination, which is when we do these things together. That SU3, so the diagonal combination, SU3 vector, is sometimes called the eightfold way. If you read old 1960s, particle physics stories, they talk about SU3 organizing the mesons and the baryons they found. That's the symmetry they're talking about. And this is why it's an approximate symmetry of the strong interactions. It works only for the light quarks because those quarks are light. But this other symmetry, the axial one, nobody was talking about. And you might say, well, that should also be there. If I can think of classifying how things transform under SU3 vector, I should also be classifying how they transform under SU3 axial. And I don't see, if this had been an exact symmetry, remember, an exact symmetry, that implies normally that the states that are related by the symmetry have to have the same mass. So states related by symmetry have the same energy. All right, we went through this whole story back at the very beginning of the course, where you know, you had to break the SU2 cross U1 electron weak in order to give people different masses, because otherwise symmetries always related things with the same mass. And so if the W boson is related to the photon by a symmetry, it's got to be massless. So what we should be expecting is that if the quark masses are light, all the states that are related by these symmetries have almost the same mass. And that was the success of the eightfold way, was that these guys, this one is all by himself under the SU3, so it should have its own mass, but these other ones should have masses that are pretty close to one another. And that's not such a convincing thing for the kaon and for the pion. But if you look at the SU2 subset, the one that we really should take to the bank, that says that that's the pi, so the pi zero, the pi plus, and the pi minus are related under that SU2. That's isospin. That's what people talk about in nuclear physics. If you look at the mesons, the proton, the baryons, the proton and the neutron transform as a doublet under this SU2 that rotates these two quarks into each other, because there's an up quark, an up quark, and a down quark, or an up quark, and a down quark, and a down quark. It's really that last quark which is rotating. So the SU2, the vector SU2, is isospin, and there's lots of evidence that isospin is a good symmetry in nature. You know, nuclear physics is full of it. The pions are all close in mass. These guys transform together under isospin, and they're close in mass. These are their antiparticles, so that's the same thing. And the 8 to 8 is all by itself under isospin, so it doesn't have to get related to things. But the pattern of masses actually agrees very well with this being a very good symmetry that rotates these two. And it's not such a bad statement about these guys being symmetry where we rotate them all. This is probably the worst case multiplet for that. But you'll see in a second why that's actually not a bad statement. So there's lots of evidence for this symmetry being there, in particular the SU2 one, which is isospin. So SU vector 2 is isospin. Honest to God, isospin from the dark ages when people did nuclear physics. What about the axial symmetry? Well, the key thing is that you don't, what you'd expect to find if the axial symmetry was similarly a symmetry would be that if the pions were related to each other by the symmetry, we should be able to get the same kind of transformations, but with a parity change by doing an axial transformation. And we'd find a bunch of pions are parity odd, and we should have found a whole bunch of parity even pions around with almost the same mass again. And you don't see that. You don't, particles don't come in multiplets of SU3 axial or SU2 axial. But you remember back in the old days, this implication here assumed that the ground state was invariant. So the SU2 cross U1 of the standard model, we went to a lot of work to make sure that it was not invariant under this symmetry, so that this implication was not true for the particles you saw in the standard model. So what we have to ask in the case of the axial symmetry is the ground state of QCD invariant under the axial part of it? And there's actually, now the story until, you know, 10 years ago was that the experimental evidence is that this ground state of QCD breaks this symmetry spontaneously, the same way that the ground state of the standard model breaks SU2 cross U1 invariant spontaneously. The strong interactions of QCD break it, and so the predictions that you would find is that instead of finding relationships amongst masses, you should find Goldstone bosons around that are the Goldstone bosons that go with spontaneous symmetry breaking always. And so the experimental evidence is that actually these guys are them. These guys should have been, a Goldstone boson is always massless if it's a Goldstone boson for an exact symmetry. But if you have an approximate symmetry, which is only really a good symmetry when the mass is zero, you should expect the particle to be light but not massless, because its mass is suppressed by the parameter which breaks the symmetry, which is essentially this. So what we would expect is the Goldstone boson for the approximate SU2 symmetry, which is better than the other ones, should be pretty light compared to everybody else. That's exactly the pions. They have exactly the quantum numbers they need to do to be the Goldstone bosons for axial SU2. And then the kaons, the rest of these guys, and that whole matrix becomes, except for A to zero, are the ones that are the Goldstone bosons for this SU3. And them being light is a bit of more of a stretch, because it relies on believing that you can expand in the strange quark mass about a bit of QCD scale. But they are, you know, lighter than everybody else. They're not a whole bunch lighter, but it's, the pattern is that the ones that are lightest are exactly the ones that should have the properties that they would have to be Goldstone bosons for spontaneously breaking the symmetry, which you know should be there. So that's the experimental evidence. On the theoretical side, there's actually good arguments now, and there's reasonable calculations that when you numerically simulate QCD, that you do find that the symmetry breaking pattern is that this axial symmetry gets broken. And there's an expectation value. If you take the ground state of QCD, it's not invariant under U. It's not equal to. And another way of saying that is that there's the ground state of QCD, take this combination Q bar Q, that's not equal to zero. That's something which that's U bar U plus D bar D plus S bar S. It's an invariant under the vector rotations, but it's always broken by the axial rotations. And so if this thing is non-zero, it can't be true that the ground state is invariant under the axial transformations. So there's good evidence that that's what's happening. So the SU3 axial is spontaneously broken. Now the thing I haven't said, which you might be bothered by, is it all sounds very, very plausible. You know, that you've got interactions that are getting strong, it's like electromagnetism. The things that like to bind are the things that are neutral because you're trying to get rid of the charge that's causing the binding. And once you get something which is neutral, then it can stop binding because you no longer feel the force that would make you bind. It's all very electromagnetic-like, but the big difference is that in electromagnetism and atoms, you see the atoms, but you also see the ions. You know, it's possible to rip an electron out of an atom, and you can see both the constituents and the bound states. And in QCD, no one's ever seen a bare quark or a bare gluon. And so the main difference, that's the main difference. That was the sticking point in this interpretation of mesons as being bound states. Everything else works like a charm. The quantum numbers are right. The energy levels are right as much as you can calculate them. There's a whole story about interactions, which I'm not talking about, which you can say a lot about. How the pions scatter from things is governed by the fact that they're Goldstone bosons for these symmetries. And so you can derive consequences for the scattering rates, which are become exact in the limit that this is small. And so you can calculate perturbatively in the ratio of the like quark masses divided by the QCD scale. And it all works. It describes well what pions do. The heavy quarks effectively interact weakly. And so how they behave in their bound states are being described well by what you would expect for QCD, for electromagnetic-like interactions. The only thing that seems funny is that you actually don't get you never seem to get the analog of ions, where the constituents are released. So I guess this is point three now, the confinement hypothesis. So the claim is that the ground state of QCD, whatever it is, if you imagined putting everything on a lattice and kind of numerically simulating everything, for a finite number of degrees of freedom, it's just quantum mechanics. And you'd have a bunch of energy states that are, some of them are colorless and some of them are colored. And you could then imagine taking the limit that you've got an infinite number of degrees of freedom and ask, how do all the energy levels change as you do that? And the assumption is, or the hypothesis is, that as you take the system to be very large, so you're getting a field theory rather than a quantum mechanics, then what happens is that all the colored degrees of freedom grow without bound in energy, so they actually become bigger than your cutoff, and it's only the colorless ones that survive. So the claim would be that only colorless states survive with finite energy in the continuum limit. Discretized, let's say. And so that would say that they're so energetic that you never see them because they're way above the cutoff in the regime where you don't really believe your theory anyway. And there's better and better and better evidence numerically that this is really a property of this of QCD. If you just on a lattice, you diagonalize things and you look at how things get bigger and bigger and bigger. it really does seem to be true that all the colored states leave at high energies, and you're only left with the colorless ones at low energies. So it's less and less of a hypothesis and more of a derived result of QCD, but it seems to be a very good description of what you see. There was a thought I had that I wanted to say. So the physical picture would be that, so that this is like a hand-waving intuition, which seems to capture a lot of what goes on. If you had a quark here and you had an anti-quark here, let's say, in electromagnetism, there'd be, you know, some force between them. And the idea is that, you know, so you'd have some sort of a force lines between these things, which would fill space for some sort of a dipole configuration in electromagnetism. The difference in QCD is that the gauge bosons themselves feel the force. And so it's as if these force lines attracted one another. And so in QCD, what happens is that schematically, the force lines all tend to bundle together because it's energetically favorable for them to do that. And so effectively, it behaves like a string that if you're trying to pull charge colors away from one another, you get an energy, you get a tension, which is much like you would have had if you had a cord between the two. And you can pull them and pull them and pull them. Eventually, though, the energy that you've put into the stretching of the string, or this effective string, it's easier to, you can release the energy better by breaking the string and putting a quark anti-quark there than to further stretch the string. And so energetically, rather than separating these quarks and indefinitely far so you can actually see them, once you get them to about the QCD scale, it's energetically easier to pull quarks out of the vacuum than it is to continue stretching the string. And so what happens is you end up with pairs of mesons rather than anything electrically colored. And so that picture seems to be actually a reasonable model for what goes on in QCD, although I think it's fair to say that picture hasn't been derived from QCD, but it phenomenologically describes a lot of what you see. So I think that's, any questions about any of that? You've been passively QCD-ized. You know, you can be more explicit about if these are symmetries, and if you're doing an expansion in masses, you know, I argued that in the exact limit that the symmetry is exact, then these things are all exactly the same mass. You can go further than that. You can say, well, if I went to linear order in perturbation theory, so the first non-trivial order, you can calculate what the splitting of these masses are. And that actually, it turns out that you have, how many parameters do you have to describe that splitting? You have, for the three light quarks, there's the three masses, you know, M up, M down, M strange. You also, I guess, have the value of this, whatever it is, that's the scale. But it turns out if you look at the splittings of the mesons and look at the splittings of the baryons, then there are fewer parameters than you have splittings of mesons and baryons. So you can actually derive a relationship amongst the splittings, which is independent of the parameters, which was done back in the 60s by the heroes of the day. And those mass formulas, the Gell-Mann of Hubbaum kind of mass formulas, the fact that they work so well is evidence that these symmetries are really, really working. So there's really quantitative evidence that this expansion makes sense in the masses of quarks divided by the QCD scale. And so you can quantify how well it's doing by looking at those kind of mass formulas and seeing they're not exact, but they're approximate. And you can see, well, how much do they fail by? In some cases, they work better than they should, probably. And that the errors, their failure is less than the strange quark divided by the QCD scale. But there's a considerable amount of quantitative things you can do by exploiting these symmetries, which are in the book and I'm not telling you about. The last thought, which I have to say before we quit, is the evidence that these constituents are there comes from deep inelastic scattering. What really convinced everybody, deep inelastic scattering, which I'm not going to describe in any detail, but it's the statement that if you take a bound state of quarks, let's say, if you scatter them very weakly, so that, you know, they're moving through space, if you were to take another particle like an electron and you say you scattered electromagnetically from the approach, say you look at proton-electron scattering, and this is a photon being exchanged, let's say. If the wavelength of the photon is much bigger than the, you know, so if the wavelength of the photon is much bigger than the size of the proton, and the size of the proton is going to be basically the QCD scale. You know, it's basically a Fermian size. And what happens is that the whole thing tends to recoil you're going to do a multiple moment expansion, and you just scatter from the whole proton. So the proton scatters coherently. So the quarks scatter coherently, and that means that essentially the whole proton recoils in a way that's not disrupting it. But if you have the wavelength much less than the QCD scale, then the energy transfer that you're delivering to the proton is extremely high compared to the binding energy or the instantaneous QCDs. The binding energy in this to be in this well is basically the QCD energy. And if you make the energy associated with 1 over lambda high compared to the QCD scale, then it's like if you hit an atom very hard, an electron in an atom very hard, it responds very quickly because it's got a very fast probe, and it gets kicked out of the atom before the rest of the atom knows it is gone. And so in that kind of a situation, one of these things will recoil very strongly, and the rest of the proton just goes along for the ride. And things remain colorless because you'll prefer, as these things start to separate by a sufficient distance that the QCD scale would be important, you pull pairs of particles out of the vacuum. And so you end up with a meson or something coming out here and something else coming out in this direction. But this process where the wavelength of the momentum transfer is very short compared to the QCD scale is well described by incoherent scattering. Of quarks. So that means that incoherent means that rather than adding the amplitudes of the scattering from each quark and then squaring the whole thing, you're supposed to calculate the rate for scattering from each quark and add the rates, because the interference between scattering from this one and this one and this one is essentially zero, because the momentum that they share, the coherence of their wave function is extremely mismatched to the probe you're hitting it with. And so that means that if you can write the scattering with a photon or a scattering with a Z boson or a neutrino could scatter with a W boson, and they're scattering, you can write the scattering in terms of the probability distribution of finding the quarks or the gluons or whatever's in there for the proton once and for all. So if you measure the distributions of quarks and gluons in the proton using electromagnetic interactions, you can then use those predictions to calculate how things will scatter when you exchange a Z boson or if you scatter neutrinos with a W boson. And so you can build a picture as to how the scattering should happen, which is not always complicated by, you have to once and for all measure the distribution of these constituents of the proton using one set of scattering. But once you've done that, you get to predict a whole bunch of other kinds of scattering. And that's a very successful set of predictions, which it really describes well what you see. And so that picture emerging at the same time as the quantum numbers is what convinced people that this picture, quarks are behaving like bound states when you look at them on long scales, because the strong interactions are strong there. But when you look at them on short scales, they behave like they're independently free particles, basically. And that's because the strong interactions are weak there. And that's consistent because of the strong interactions being asymptotically free, that the coupling really gets weaker the shorter the distances you look at it. So the whole picture really holds together really well in a way which is much more quantitative than I'm alluding to here. And now you've seen QCD. So I'll stop talking about QCD from now on. Any questions with that?